The War of Our Time, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. For 7 years, the BBC's Lise Doucette has risked her life to report on the war in Syria, and she's not going to stop.
It is a war of our time. It's a humanitarian test of our time, and I think it's suffered from the fact that it hasn't had enough reporters on the ground to actually report with their own eyes and ears exactly what has happened.
And later, he grew up a mild-mannered, helpful boy in northern Uganda.
He would wake up early in the morning and clean and go tend to the garden.
Then he was abducted by the Lord's Resistance Army, or LRA.
People say he became one of the LRA's most brutal, high-ranking killers.
The story of Dominic Onwin, that's coming up right here on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Glad to have you with us. Out of sight, out of mind. Seems horrible to say, but that's what the war in Syria can feel like. These days, there's not a lot of daily reporting on the conflict, now in its seventh year. And here in the U.S., when we do hear about Syria, it's often in the context of U.S. policy, detached from the harsh realities on the ground. The Syrian government restricts access to the country, and most news organizations have concluded that covering the war is just too dangerous. So very few Western journalists do. But my BBC colleague Lise Doucette is on the front lines in eastern Syria right now, traveling with Syrian government troops. She just returned from Sukna, a town where regime forces have just pushed out ISIS fighters.
Not a single building on a single street was left intact. When Islamic State stormed into the town of Sukna 3 years ago, almost everyone fled. When we got there with the Syrian army, the IS fighters had also fled. In fact, we know that they then retreated to Deir ez-Zor, and more than 200 of them were killed by a Russian airstrike. We did, though, visit some of the houses, which were basically full of pockmarked walls, gaping holes, the floors collapsed like concrete pancakes by the 3 years of fierce fighting that have gone on there. In one room, for example, we saw boxes of munitions and next to them jumbled women's clothing. And the soldiers said that IS had kept women there. And in the hallway, another grisly scene where there was hooks hanging from the ceiling and then cords attached to them. The soldiers told us they had seen those in a number of the houses which were used as makeshift bases, and they told us that they were used for torture.
Lise, tell us about the government troops and commanders you're traveling with.
It's quite unusual for Western journalists to travel with top Syrian generals to get them to talk to you. But for some reason this time, two Syrian generals who we met in Sukna, we got out of the car because we wanted to look at a road sign for Sukna, which had been defaced by the black signature of IS, which was, you know, daubed over the road sign. And this gleaming white vehicle drove past us and screeched to a halt, and out jumps a Syrian general with these mirrored aviated glasses and struts over and wants to tell us how important this victory is. I've never had that happening. It may be a measure of how pleased they are by this latest victory. We also were driven to the advanced firing position by the general, which is the commanding officer for all of the eastern operations, General Mohammed Khadour. And he was very much the soldier, very charismatic for his men, but very controversial. He has served on almost every major front in the past 6 years and more, crushing the rebels. He has a reputation of bulldozing his way through. He actually boasted that he was on the EU sanctions list, accused by the EU of suppressing peaceful protest in the Damascus suburb of Douma in 2011. And he raised it without us even asking, and laughed it off.
How close are you getting to IS troops? I mean, are you seeing them, and are they basically back on their heels as a fighting group?
They are retreating to their last redoubts. It's believed that Deir ez-Zor in the northeast is one of the places where they're going to really dig in. I don't think you'd want to meet IS fighters, given what their record of imprisoning and torturing and executing journalists. When we were at the Syrian army's advanced firing position, we were told that they were about a kilometer away from where we were on this vast expanse of desert.
You've been traveling with the Syrian army, who gets help from Russia and Iran as it battles ISIS. Then there's the Kurds, who are backed by the U.S. They're also battling ISIS. But what's going to happen when these rivals no longer have a common enemy, the Islamic State? Is there concern that they will turn their sights on each other?
Well, that is the big question now. The Russians and the Syrian army are concentrating on Deir ez-Zor. So the Americans, once they help the Kurdish and Arab forces take back Raqqa, the big question is, what will they do then? Will they help the Syrian opposition? Will they let President Assad continue his advance backed by his very powerful friends?
Lise, my final question is a personal one. How do you keep doing this?
Anyone who visited Syria before the war will remember it as a country of warm hospitality, kind people, a middle-income Arab country which had decent roads, the schools weren't bad, it was self-sufficient in pharmaceuticals. And now, if year by year, we have seen the pain that Syrians feel on all sides of this conflict. It does draw you in, and you feel a certain responsibility if you can get to Syria, because it's not easy. Either it's too dangerous in some areas or it's hard to get visas. It is a war of our time. It's a humanitarian test of our time. And I think it's suffered from the fact that it hasn't had enough reporters on the ground to actually report with their own eyes and ears exactly what has happened.
The BBC's Lise Doucet, she's been reporting on the front lines in Syria. Thanks so much, Lise.
Thank you.
There are more than 1.5 million Syrian refugees in Lebanon. They make up almost a quarter of the population there now. Lebanon is a small country, so as you might imagine, the large refugee presence has strained resources. That's led to a backlash, and it's been getting worse lately. The World's Richard Hall spoke with Syrian refugees in the Lebanese town of Bar Elias.
I meet Rifat in the middle of summer in her sweltering shelter in this Syrian refugee camp. She doesn't want me to use her full name because her Lebanese visa has expired and she's scared. Her two boys, Mohammed and Ahmed, play around us. She has another child on the way, but instead of resting during the final months of her pregnancy, she is looking for a smuggler to sneak her and her family across the border back home.
When we first came, we were treated well. But when the number of Syrian refugees increased, the people started complaining. It has got to a point where whenever we go outside, we hear them saying, the Syrians are taking our jobs, are filling up our country.
The situation for Syrians in Lebanon today is so difficult that many are contemplating the same unthinkable thing, returning home to a country that is still at war. Fira, who fled to Lebanon from Damascus 5 years ago, struggles to get by on aid deliveries to the camp. She does some cleaning work in the town, but says she is treated like a slave by her Lebanese employers. Her story is a familiar one to Syrians living in Lebanon, but she says things have never been this bad. In late June, 4 Syrians died in the custody of the Lebanese army after being detained in a raid on the refugee camp. Rights groups say their bodies showed signs of torture. Days later, 2 refugee settlements not far from Rifat's home were burned down. Officials said the fires were accidents, but few believed it. These incidents and others have created a climate of fear among Syrians. You're hearing a video that was uploaded to Facebook last month. It shows a group of Lebanese men attacking a Syrian man on the street. They are kicking and punching him and demanding that he swear allegiance to the army. The man is cowering and looks terrified. Underneath the video, many people are posting messages of support to the attackers. Firat and others in our camp see these videos and read these comments in disbelief.
We sit together here and discuss these comments. We get very upset and scared because we cannot even say, why are you saying this? Because we are afraid. We are afraid that they will jump on us. This is what hurts most, that we cannot defend ourselves.
A little way down the road, in another camp, 24-year-old Khaled is keen to let me know that not all Lebanese treat Syrians badly. But he too has leaving on his mind. His 1-year-old daughter sits next to us while we talk. Khaled, who only gives his first name, says he is ready to leave now, not tomorrow. He will leave everything behind. He will live in a smaller tent than the one he is in now. At least he would be in his own country, he says. He says that a few bad Syrians have turned the Lebanese against them. He's referring to the steady wave of terror attacks that have hit Lebanon since Hezbollah joined the Syrian war in 2013. Dozens of Lebanese people have been killed. Worry over security surely plays on the mind of many Lebanese. They fear a repeat of their own civil war, when the country was divided over the status of Palestinian refugees. Others are concerned about the impact such a large number of Syrians has had on the Lebanese economy. The World Bank estimates that 200,000 Lebanese have been pushed into poverty as a result of the Syrian crisis. Lebanese politicians are stepping up their rhetoric too. Their calls for Syrians to return home have grown louder, despite the UN saying it's still not safe there. Firat and Khaled are fearful of what awaits them over the border in Syria. That's the only reason they're still here in Lebanon. In the meantime, Firat says that what she wants most in the world is patience from others.
I would tell the Lebanese, we are here, you are right, we are in your country, but it's not our will to be here. We are not happy to be here. We are in a situation that should make you feel pity for us and be patient with us. We cannot do anything else. We do not have any other choice. Empathize with us, because we have been through so much misery.
For the world, Richard Hall in Bar Ilyas, Lebanon.
That's the voice of Rafael Felo Ramirez. The legendary Cuban-American broadcaster died earlier this week. He was 94. For decades, he was the Miami Marlins' Spanish-language radio voice. In 2001, he was inducted into the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Alberto Vasallo III heads the El Mundo Boston newspaper. He grew up listening to Ramirez.
I, as a Cuban-American, I obviously my father and my uncle being Cuban, that's how I was introduced, because they were so proud of the fact that this very well-known icon all over Latin America had his roots in Cuba, in Havana. My father had been listening to him. And then when I got a chance to meet him when I was much younger, my dad was very excited. So he's been part of my baseball life since I kind of fell in love with baseball after like the 1975 World Series.
So what was it like when you finally met him?
Oh, it was awesome. It was like, you know, when someone today meets like a Vin Scully or, you know, one of these voices that you grow up with, and you finally have them in front of you. It's, you know, you get all these emotions, and, you know, he was already, you know, probably in his 70s. So to me at that time, you know, I was in my 20s. He was an older guy, right? but no, he was energetic, and, you know, at that point, I thought he was, wow, this guy's been doing this for so long. Then it's, you know, 15, 20 years later, I kept seeing him at Fenway. He just kept getting older but better and still doing it. So, oh yeah, he was energetic and the same guy that I thought it would be. He was so nice. So it was great to finally see the face of the voice that you had grown up with.
You've been a fan of Felo Ramirez, but you've also been following his career, his very long career. Can you give us some highlights of his career?
Well, you know, he's been with the Marlins since you know, they came into existence at MLB. Now, as a Yankee hater, you know, as a Bostonian Yankee hater, when the Marlins beat the Yankees in that World Series, it was 2003, Felo had the call. And I remember listening to it because I was so happy, not so much for the Marlins, but the fact that the Yankees had lost. So to me, he will always represent a great moment in which I was happy, because if you remember that year, Aaron Boone hit the home run, and I always thought the Red Sox should be playing the Marlins. So that's, you know, ironically enough, one of the moments that I'll always remember about Felo, his call of the 2003 World Series win.
Felo Ramirez was Cuban-American, but his following extended far beyond his homeland, something that not many Spanish-language broadcasters managed to achieve. What was it about him that you think made him such an icon in Latin American baseball circles?
He was like the grandfather, right? He was the standard for which that generation of broadcasters looked up to. And he was so talented because he was like a one-man crew, right? So he kind of got used to doing the whole play-by-play by himself. So it was just the way he made me feel more than how he did it. You know, it was, you know, I'm in my 40s now, but he still reminds me like when I started to fall in love with baseball in my, you know, way back then in my teens. So it was more of how he made me feel than how he did it.
Alberto Vasallo III is the president and CEO of El Mundo Boston, a Latino newspaper in New England. Thanks so much, Alberto.
Thank you.
What to do about Uganda's former child soldiers? That's up next, here on The World.
I like words.
A podcast.
Crunchy, crackly words.
About language.
Trixie, Tucker, Gentile.
The world in words.
Oh heavens, my gracious landsake words.
The world in words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Uganda is in a much better place now. The bloody 20-year insurgency led by the Lord's Resistance Army has come to an end. But the country is still grappling with the issue of child soldiers. These are boys abducted at a very young age and then trained against their will to be killers. Now that many of those boys are adults, there's a dilemma for Uganda. How do you judge a former child soldier? As a victim or as a perpetrator? For the first time ever, the International Criminal Court is putting a former child soldier on trial. It's a case that has polarized his home country. The World's Jasmine Garst has the story from Uganda.
No one seems to remember what the boy's real name was, but his cousin, Lily Atong, remembers him well. When she talks about him, she gets a distant, wistful look in her eyes.
He would wake up in the morning, just like a normal boy in the village, and start with cleaning the compound.
They grew up together, here in this village in northern Uganda. The boy was chubby, she says with a smile.
One memory, that young man digging potatoes. And so the sweet potatoes, there is a way, a specific way you can make it from the garden and cook it right there.
He would wake up early in the morning and clean and go tend to the garden. He made her these delicious roasted sweet potatoes, and he was funny, too. He'd tell these stories and make everyone double over in laughter.
Dong Wen is a good storyteller, that if we had sat here like this and you hear people shouting, it could be him. He would be making them all laughing, because he's a good storyteller and he likes to jazz, yeah.
There wasn't much to laugh about back then. It was the height of the war. An armed Christian militia, known as the Lord's Resistance Army, or LRA, fought the Ugandan government for control over the region. And the LRA specifically targeted children. They would storm into a village and snatch up the boys and turn them into soldiers. They'd also take young girls to be wives and sex slaves. All in all, around 30,000 kids were taken during the conflict. When the boy was 10 years old, he too was abducted and trained to be a soldier. And people say he became one of the LRA's most brutal, high-ranking killers. In Uganda, the name Dominique Ongwen sends chills down some people's spines. He fought for decades and is alleged to have been brutal. He surrendered 2 years ago to American special forces.
All rise, vous vous levez.
These days, Ongwen is on trial at the International Criminal Court in The Hague. He faces 70 counts of war crimes and crimes against humanity. Here's Ongwen speaking through a translator.
I deny all these charges in respect to the war in northern Uganda.
He's the first child soldier to ever have been tried at the International Criminal Court. And his defense has been simple. I was taken as a little boy. I was forced to do these things. He's a victim, says his cousin Lily. It's not like he volunteered. Anyone else would have done that in order to survive. But the people who abducted him and put a gun in his hand, they're walking around town free. She's not alone in this view. Ongwen is one of just two LRA fighters facing charges. Even mastermind Joseph Kony, who headed the armed militia, is still at large. Traveling around Uganda, I find a lot of people feel sorry for Ongwen. At one point in the city of Gulu, I hop in a taxi. The driver tells me he feels for Ongwen. You see, the driver himself was abducted as a little boy and forced to become a child soldier. He says watching Ongwen in that sterile European courtroom surrounded by judges, it's like watching himself on trial. Not everyone feels compassion for Dominique Ongwen. The town of Lukoti is green and red. Green bush cut by red clay roads. I follow one of those roads uphill to the village schoolhouse. Principal Oyet sits with me in the yard. He tells me as a child, he was abducted 5 times by the Lord's Resistance Army. He always ran away.
I was abducted several times, almost 5 times.
He's a quirky man who smiles and laughs often as he talks, which is somewhat jarring because of what he wants to tell me about, how he survived one of the country's most notorious massacres. The townspeople had been camping right outside of an army base for protection. And one evening, the LRA raided the camp. It's said that Dominique Onwen led the operation.
They came in large number, almost over 80. They were making a lot of sound. So we ran, and from a distance, we saw smoke coming out of the camp. We spent the night in the bush. In the morning, when we came back, we found a smell. Other human beings were burned. Other people were abducted.
Over 60 people were killed in the massacre at Lukodi, Principal Oyet's family. Oyet says it's really frustrating to hear his countrymen say Dominique Onwen should not be held responsible because he was a child soldier. Oyet says at the end of the day, Dominique Onwen was a man when he killed most of the people in this village.
At the time that he did the attack, he was above 18 years old. So to me, he was a matured person at the time of the act.
In summer, in Uganda, every night there is a storm. On this night in Lukodi, it's the 13th anniversary of the massacre, and there's a memorial service. Under an electric black sky, survivors file in through the waist-tall wild grass. They have gathered to sing in front of a monument with the names of the victims of the massacre. They're a small bunch. After a war, justice is always complicated. There are victims and there are perpetrators, but some people end up being both. So who do you judge? The chubby 10-year-old boy who loved to tend to his garden? The one who got abducted? Or the murderer he's accused of becoming? For the World, I'm Jasmine Garzd, Lukodi, Uganda.
Before we take a break, here's a quick preview for a story we'll have for you tomorrow. It's about the Arizona law that banned Mexican-American studies programs in the state's schools. This week, a federal judge ruled that the law was racist and unconstitutional because it violated the rights of Mexican-American students. Tomorrow, we hear from the teacher who created the program at the heart of the case. Curtis Acosta says his goal in creating a Mexican-American studies program in Tucson was to allow Mexican-American kids to learn their own history and respect themselves as scholars.
It was a struggle, you know, like trying to convince students that they have this ability to be scholarly when they've been told their whole lives that they're not.
And we meet one of the students who took Acosta's class and was transformed.
My mind was completely blown. It sort of felt kind of like we were sort of like breaking into this thing that we weren't supposed to be in and kind of like positioning ourselves within it.
How that Mexican-American studies program in Tucson led to 2 lawsuits. That story coming up tomorrow on the show.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, remembering singer Paul Robeson's love affair with communist Russia.
Long live our Soviet motherland, built by the people's mighty hand.
When the Harlem Renaissance went to Moscow, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Putting the past in a modern context is a tricky thing to do. We've certainly experienced that firsthand here in the U.S. post-Charlottesville. Yesterday, we heard how the Greek city of Thessaloniki is also struggling to come to terms with parts of its history. The city once had a thriving Jewish presence, but 96% of Thessaloniki's Jews were killed during the Holocaust.
It took a long time for Thessaloniki to accept its history.
That's Hela Kunyomatalon, a member of Thessaloniki's small Jewish community. She says that for decades, a small Jewish museum and a statue were the only reminders of Thessaloniki's past. But that's beginning to change, and many in the city give credit to Thessaloniki's current mayor. Yanis Boutaris has been trying to shine a light on the city's history. And he's been doing that just as the popularity of the ultranationalist far-right Golden Dawn Party has risen in Greece. Here again is the world's Lydia Emanolidou. She gave Mayor Boutaris a call.
Yeah. Hi, is this Mayor Boutaris?
Yeah.
Let me just give you a little bit of background about Boutaris, because he's not really your typical Greek mayor. He's 75 years old. He comes to politics by way of business. He never wears a tie. He has tattoos. And people love to talk about how he wears this diamond stud in his left ear. So he's really not your typical mayor, and he takes a progressive approach to a lot of issues. And he told me that when he came into office, he came in wanting to confront Thessaloniki's Jewish past.
When I became mayor, I said one specific thing. You cannot build your future if you don't know your past.
So the mayor sees the country in an economic crisis. He sees the rise of the Golden Dawn. He sees anti-Semitism against this small minority, the small Jewish population. And he's really worried about what that might lead to.
He sounds like a really unusual guy. He's not Jewish, is he?
No, he's not. He's not Jewish. But he told me that his family growing up was friends with a lot of Jewish families. So I think he has some personal reasons for pursuing this. And he's done a number of things since taking office in 2010. He's helped put this really big museum project on track. So the city is going to open a 6-story Holocaust museum, likely in 2019. It's going to be the only museum in Europe that's built right by the rail tracks where members of the Jewish community were taken to concentration camps. And he also wants to highlight the history that came before the Holocaust and get rid of this notion that still persists today, that somehow, because of their religion, Jews are not Greek.
The Jews of Thessaloniki are more patriots than us. The issue is that the truth about the presence of the Jewish community in the city must be restored. And there, I won't step back.
So I mentioned the Holocaust Museum. You know, he's been involved in a number of projects, putting up plaques and taking public stances. Like, he wore a Star of David at his second inauguration ceremony.
I'm curious if the mayor has gotten any pushback on all his efforts for the city to really embrace its Jewish heritage.
Yeah. One of the things he's been promoting is having public school kids visit the Jewish Museum of Thessaloniki. And while I was at the museum, I sat down with the museum's director. Her name is Erika Perachiazemur. And she told me that about 3 years ago, there were 700 students or so who visited the museum annually. Today, there are 3,000. And not everybody's very happy about that.
Έχουμε καθηγητές που μας έχουν πει ότι έχουν πρόβλημα με γονείς.
We have teachers who've told us they have problems with the parents of kids they bring to the museum. Yesterday, for example, I had a teacher from an area of Thessaloniki that votes 15% Golden Dawn. And one of the parents told him, why are you teaching the kids these things? The Holocaust doesn't exist. It never happened.
And even though there is that pushback, all the members of the Jewish community I spoke with said that, you know, at least the city is making some progress. It feels like it really has, under the leadership of Mayor Boutaris, made some progress. And I was curious to hear what a Holocaust survivor thinks about Mayor Boutaris. So I asked Hela what her father thinks about the mayor. Her father's actually still alive.
That's amazing. How
yeah.
old is he?
He's in his 90s now. And so I asked her what he thinks about all this.
My father is very proud of the mayor and of what he's doing. About the other issue of the Golden Dawn, there he's very skeptical. And every time we speak about it, he compares it with the Nazi Germany. Because there also the extreme right party did not spread like that 1 year before the Holocaust. They started everything 10 years before, and nobody believed that something bad would happen.
I think this really shows that Thessaloniki is at this point where it's starting to confront its past. I think there's more awareness about the Jewish community today, but it's also at a point where it doesn't know where the country is heading. And so a lot of people are also worried.
That's the world's Lydia Emanuelito. Thanks so much, Lydia.
Thank you.
If you're a tennis fan, as I am, Monday's a big day. It's the start of the U.S. Open in Flushing Meadows, New York. Big names will be there, but there might be some surprises in store, too.
It's crazy. What a season it's been, Carol, with all the injuries. I think it's as open as it's ever been.
That's because there's a new crop of talented up-and-comers from around the globe, particularly among the men. Rob Koenig is a commentator for the Association of Tennis Professionals, or ATP. He says one of those players is Alexander Zverev, known as Sasha. He's from Germany and the son of two Russian tennis players. And he defeated tennis god Roger Federer earlier this month.
He's one of only two players to currently win multiple Masters 1000 titles outside of the Big Four. So at a young age, this guy's got the belief, and without a doubt, he's got the firepower to challenge at the tail end of a major. 6'6", huge game, huge wingspan. He's already put on 25 pounds of prime filet, if you want to call it that. He's in good shape, and he surrounded himself with a good team, and that's something that Roger Federer did early on in his career. So I think Zverev is very well placed, Carol.
What about the other up-and-coming men? Who will you be watching at the U.S. Open in the next couple of weeks?
Well, let me fire off some names for you. Probably next in line is somebody called Kharen Khachanov from Russia. He's a big boy as well. He's currently at a career high ranking at number 30 in the world. The Russians have got a nice crop as well. There's this young kid called Andrei Rublev, who's just 19. Then as far as the Americans are concerned, Jared Donaldson, just 20 years of age, has had a fantastic 12 months and a fantastic summer. He's different from the other Americans in that he spent 2 years away from America, training down in South America to get used to the clay, took himself out of his comfort zone, and it's really paid dividends. He's also right around a career high rank, and he's sitting around 50 in the world. Watch out for Jared. Then you've got this young Canadian kid, Denis Shapovalov, who we saw play so well in Canada. Big game. Roger Federer spoke glowingly about him.
And he also has Russian roots. What goes on in Russia? Why are they producing all these players?
Treat them mean, keep them keen, Carol. They're very hard workers, and they've got a fantastic work ethic. And they grow up tough. You know, they don't have a lot of money, some of these guys. And, you know, they're not mollycoddled
like Americans.
Yes, a fair few players in America are. So I think that gives you a desire and a mindset that's so much tougher. You know, it becomes all or nothing. You either make it in tennis or you're nothing. And I think having only one option is sometimes a good thing.
Do you detect different styles or approaches to tennis among this new crop that's coming up?
Not really, not enough variation. And in fact, Roger Federer mentioned that at Wimbledon this year. He feels that the guys aren't coming in and showing enough variation to challenge at the sharp end of these tournaments. Now I'm talking about winning, not just making it through to the quarters or through to the semis. So I think it's important that they develop their games even further. So I think the ones that are really going to break out from this young gun group are those who have the variety. And of course, we've seen that with Zverev. He is one of these guys who does have the variety and not just the firepower.
I want to ask about Francis Tiafoe. He's American. He was an immigrant. His father worked at a tennis club, I think as a maintenance man in Maryland, and that's where he got his start. What's he looking like this year?
Bit of adversity early on in the summer. Went on a four-match losing streak, but really has picked it up nicely now. Played really well in Cincinnati. I commentated on a few of his matches there, and of course he beats Zverev there. And when you win a match like that, it gives you an incredible amount of self-belief. He is a hell of an athlete, and that's the one thing that really is in Francis's favor. His story and his game style is exciting to watch, and I hope he does go deep at the U.S. Open because I think it'll add to the U.S. Open story, Carol.
So who do you want to win?
I'm pretty neutral. I've got a lot of people who are wanting Federer to make it third time this year that he's won a major. But, you know, you're right. It would be nice to see one of these youngsters break through and just rattle the cage a little bit. I'd love to see Zverev go deep. I'd love to see Shapovalov go deep. He is an incredible talent. He's such an exciting player to watch, and I think we need that in our sport, Carol.
Rob Koenig is a tennis commentator for the Association of Tennis Professionals, or ATP. He's going to be at the U.S. Open. Thanks, Rob.
Always a pleasure, Carol.
Critics say he's one of the greatest artists of the 20th century. Martin Ramirez was a Mexican immigrant. He died in 1963 at the age of 68. And all these years later, he's getting his first major exhibit in Los Angeles. Ramirez has quite the story. He spent more than 30 years in California mental hospitals. And he's an artist who's often been thought of as outsider. But the 50 drawings going on display at the Institute of Contemporary Art speak to the legacy of Ramirez as a master of the immigrant experience. Giselle Regatao reports.
Let's see what's in here. This is the prints and photographs.
Tracy Barton is a senior archives technician at the Library of Congress in Washington. Today she's taking me to a locked room tucked away in a corner.
You and I are going to the vault, which is really exciting, where they keep like their really special things.
Welcome.
The special thing we've come to see is one of Martin Ramirez's drawings.
Shall we? If you'll start untying the...
Barton found this piece in 2009. It was rolled up in a box with the belongings of the designers Charles and Ray Eames.
I've worked at the library 35 years, so that's pretty much the greatest thing that's happened to me here.
In the drawing, Madonna's standing on a moon with a snake.
With her arms stretched up. A cloth draped across her arms, and she's wearing a wonderful striped dress and a crown, and she has like these sparkly large eyes, beautiful eyes.
There are cars around her and tunnels. Ramirez also drew a lot of cowboys, horses, and trains. He didn't have paint or canvas. He used crayons and pieces of paper glued together for his drawings. About 500 of them still exist.
He's an immigrant artist. His art is very important to understand borders, how people cross borders.
Victor Espinosa spent 10 years researching the artist. His recently published book is called Martin Ramirez, Framing His Life and Art. Espinosa says Ramirez left Mexico in 1925, leaving behind a pregnant wife and three kids. He went to California to find work in the railroads and mines. But when the Great Depression hit a few years later...
He lost his job and started living in the streets. And his friends voluntarily decided to go back to Mexico, but he doesn't.
Espinosa says Ramirez was picked up on the street one day and he seemed confused and was probably depressed. He didn't speak English. He ended up at a mental hospital in 1931, labeled a schizophrenic. But Espinosa questions that diagnosis. He says it was based on one problematic consultation.
The meeting was very short. They didn't use any translator. Ramirez was just saying in the meeting, mi no loco, but they say this is a typical case of schizophrenia. Ramirez didn't have anybody on his side to question the diagnosis, to do anything.
And he stayed institutionalized for the rest of his life. In 1949, a professor named Tarmo Pasto, who studied art produced by psychiatric patients, noticed Ramirez's drawings.
He went to see Ramirez working every day. He was providing paper, things like that.
Pasto helped organize Ramirez's first gallery show in 1952. But his drawings were presented as the work of an anonymous schizophrenic patient, not an artist.
And that grand narrative is hard for the art world to unabsorb because it's sexy and enticing and it reaffirms that the artist is some mythical figure.
Brooke Davis Anderson curated a major show about Ramirez at the Folk Art Museum in New York in 2007. She says it's time to change the narrative about him.
So that an artist like Ramirez, Mexican, poor, self-taught, brave, bold, ingenious, risk-taker, things that aren't often said about Ramirez, taking an artist like that and a man like that and making sure that the art world has space for him.
The fact that Ramirez was seen as a mythical figure also meant no one looked for his family until Victor Espinosa tracked them down in Mexico in 2000. The family sued to get the rights over Ramirez's work. These days, his major drawings sell for $500,000. Yet, few major museums have Ramirez in their collections.
We are probably behind, frankly.
Donna DeSalvo is a senior curator at the Whitney Museum of American Art in New York. It doesn't own a Ramirez.
There's a number of Latinx artists also that are not in our collection, and it's something we're very aware of. We've actually been bringing in some consultants where we didn't have the expertise. So mea culpa, because I think it's better to be honest about it, because that's the only way to move forward.
Slowly, things are moving forward. MoMA in New York acquired two of his pieces in the past few years. And in 2015, the U.S. Postal Service put out a set of 5 commemorative Martin Ramirez stamps. The only other Mexican artist who apparently had the honor was Frida Kahlo. For The World, Gisele Regatao, New York.
I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World.
I am your son, white man. Georgia dusk in the turpentine woods. One of the pillars of the temple fell. You are my son like hell.
That's Langston Hughes reading from his poem, Mulatto. And here's a piece of history I didn't know much about. In the early 1930s, leading figures from the Harlem Renaissance, including Langston Hughes, traveled to the USSR for artistic collaborations. Jennifer Wilson wrote an essay in the New York Times about the connection between the Harlem Renaissance and communist Russia. Jennifer, I was fascinated to read in your article that Langston Hughes and a group of 21 other African Americans actually traveled to Russia in the early 1930s to make a movie about race relations. What was it and what happened?
In 1932, Louise Patterson, who was head of the Harlem branch of Friends of the Soviet Union, was approached by representatives from Moscow about potentially making a film on race relations in the United States. And she was lucky enough to recruit Langston Hughes, who was a friend of hers, and he was known as a communist sympathizer, to help produce the film and to work on assembling a cast. And there were many different versions of the script, but essentially the main sort of plot line was about black workers and white workers in the American South who were experiencing tensions between their two groups, and essentially a labor organizer who's sort of a stand-in for communism in the Soviet Union explains to them that, you know, your struggles are connected and that these racial divisions are a tool of your capitalist oppressors.
So in a way, it was a way to kind of promote a Soviet view of the workplace and of race relations. Did the film ever get made?
No, the film did not get made. And there is many different theories about why. Some people thought that the Soviet Union, who was trying to get official recognition from the United States, was worried that a film exposing the horrors of American racism might interfere with that process. Langston Hughes and Louise Patterson, for their part, did not actually think that was the case. Langston, who had been involved in the screenwriting, working on the script, he had seen the various versions, which were all pretty bad. He thought that it was really just a matter of a poor creative project that did not manifest well, and he just thought they were abandoning it because it just wasn't quite clicking creatively. And he was, you know, not too disappointed, because he stayed on in the Soviet Union for several months, and he, you know, worked there essentially as a freelance journalist.
What kind of reception did he get?
He was warmly received by his report, a record of what happened. He tells this story of being in line for food, and there was, you know, obviously a long line, as there was in the Soviet Union, for goods. And he tells a story of someone in the line looking at him and saying, "Let the Negro comrade go to the front." So he paints quite a rosy picture of race relations in the Soviet Union, which some people have criticized him for.
Why were black artists and intellectuals in the 1930s and 40s drawn to Russia and communism?
You know, with any group, black people were not a monolith, and black leftists were not a monolith. There were certainly black liberals who were really interested in kind of a gradual theory of progress. But there were definitely many African Americans who thought that you needed a more radical approach to achieve racial equality in the United States. And the Communist Party of the United States, the CPUSA, had been really involved, particularly in the 30s and 1940s, in anti-racist campaigns. I think most famously, they were behind the effort to desegregate the blood supply of the Red Cross. So I think that a lot of people were looking to the Communist Party and seeing some really positive actions and positive steps. And so I think that certainly the group that went to Russia were part of that milieu.
Now, another African-American who had a long love affair with communist Russia is the famous singer Paul Robeson. Here's a recording of him singing the Soviet national anthem in 1944.
United forever in friendship and labor, our mighty republics will ever endure.
Jennifer, what drew Paul Robeson to Russia in the first place?
As was the case with a lot of the Black creatives who traveled to the Soviet Union, he just couldn't find opportunities in the United States. I mean, in his case, it was both because he was Black, but also because he was an avowed communist. So the Soviet Union offered, you know, an opportunity just to work, to do his work as an actor. And the film director, Sergei Eisenstein, who's more famous for his movies about the Russian Revolution, like Strike and October,
and
was really interested in making a film about the Haitian Revolution. And so he invited Paul Robeson to Moscow to star as Toussaint Louverture, the leader of the Haitian Revolution.
Why was the Soviet Union so interested in racism in America?
Well, the Soviet Union was internationalist from the very beginning. Lenin and Trotsky did not believe that you could sustain socialism just in one country. They really believed that you needed this network of different communist states around the globe in order to make this sustainable. And they saw in the United States that African Americans were by far the most oppressed group of people there, and they believed that as a result, they were the group that was most likely to stir a revolution in America. So that's why I think Lenin and Trotsky were so invested in anti-racism as a communist project.
You've studied this a lot, and I wonder what you think about how this moment in history, when Black Americans were traveling to Moscow in search of equality, how is it relevant today?
Well, I think what's really struck me about this is, you know, you look at this movie that Langston Hughes went to film in the Soviet Union, and that was 1932, so that was 85 years ago. And we still see that it's very difficult for Black artists and filmmakers and writers to really push through. You know, it's still newsworthy when a Black film is, you know, helmed by a Black director, or when a Black actor is cast in a big budget Hollywood film. So we're still really struggling with this. So for me, it's just interesting how little progress has been made in 85 years.
Jennifer Wilson is a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Pennsylvania. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Long live our Soviet motherland.
And that's our show today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Carol Hills. Back tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.